Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. Once again, Brian, welcome back for part two of our discussions.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start where we left off. And I'm going to swing the topic round to something that we should talk about, and that, of course, is law. How about law in Hong Kong? Are we happy with the way that's progressing? What's your take on that?
So firstly, I must caveat and offer a disclaimer. I'm not an expert in the law, you know.
Me too.
Oh, you are an expert, though. You're a career expert. You understand the ins and outs of this system. And
I've been around.
You have. And I'd like to just paraphrase another mentor and an academic friend whom I respect very dearly, you know. We are trained in the political sciences. We're not lawyers. We really shouldn't be asked for our thoughts and judgments on the legal system. I would say, with that said, with that caveat in mind, two things about Hong Kong's current state of play and also legal system at large. Firstly, one of the primary uses and functions that Hong Kong possesses for its motherland, for China, is that we are supposedly, and we are to be, one of the few cities and jurisdictions on Chinese soil that enjoys access and unbridled access, so to speak, as well as seamless connectivity with a common law system in the world. We are the city that foreign businesses and MNCs would go to and turn to when they're doing business with the mainland, because in many ways they don't see the mainland Chinese legal system as necessarily reflective of the way they do things internationally. And a common law is indeed an instrument of great significance, of great seminality, through the precedent-based and also the case-based approach it adopts. This fairly objective and open interpretive process that it includes, the jury trial and incorporation of that in its methods and procedures. These are all virtues that are so long-standing and apparent that even Xi Jinping, right, the General Secretary of the Communist Party of China, said twice in his speech on July the 1st in 2022 that a common law is vital in Hong Kong. I would never have expected a leader of the party, this party or any other party or that's a communist party, to speak of the common law in such a manner that affirms its importance. And I bet you $100 his speech probably shocked many a junior cadre who would listen to it and think, is that really what he said? Is that really what he said? But that's what President Xi said.
So that's right.
And he also said that one country, two systems is here to stay. Such a good system. Why change it? Upon reading it, you might think, this is just standard sort of party speak. It's a lip service. But no, here's what I would say. When you're talking about speeches issued on such an important occasion, the party or the party leader that's uttering these remarks isn't just engaging in pointless lip service. He means it. And in saying this, he was not only seeking to reassure the very skeptical international investor sentiment in the aftermath of all that's happened, of course, in 3 years prior to then, but he was also trying to send a message to the rest of the bureaucracy and the system. Don't touch the common law of Hong Kong. Leave it intact. Because it's useful for the party. It's useful for the country, right? And so it's a self-interest-centered argument I'm making here, right? To those of you who are listening and think, this is all balderdash. It's self-interest analysis. It's an analysis of what makes the most sense for the Communist Party. And that's the first one I want to convey here, which is why does the party have an interest in keeping Hong Kong's common law jurisdiction intact? And mind you, the talk of building parallel sort of Hong Kong replicas, Kui Hainan, Kui Qianhai, even in Shanghai. I mean, these projects are nice ideas that are being germinated, but it's thought that you'd get the same kind of legal like density, okay, of Oxbridge, London-trained barristers working in Hainan as you currently do in Hong Kong. That I find a tad implausible. Perhaps, and hopefully, in 30 to 40 years' time, my hope is that Hong Kong's common law system could serve as an exemplar for judicial reforms in special economic zones and also special legal zones within China, where the party would say, you know what, we're going to carve out these regions within particular cities or even entire cities and have them implement common law. But in order to ensure that we can trust the people who are administering the courts and who are prevailing over the courts, we're going to appoint Hong Kong lawyers and barristers who are trained in the common law tradition, but who are also Chinese citizens and passport holders. Now that is, in my view, a dream scenario where Hong Kong really can play a role of being a leader of change, a spearheader of reform, as opposed to faffing about and talking a lot about assimilating, integrating, without thinking about how we could add value to the rest of the GBA and indeed, by extension, the rest of the country at large. The second comment I would make, though, is when it comes to the perceptions, when it comes to the judgments, not the judgments in the court, but a judgment that international investors and businesses and firms currently cast make about our legal system, the perceptions amongst them, we've got to face it, Jonathan, you and I both know, we have a serious optical problem, okay? And when I say optical, I don't just mean it's a PR problem. It's not just a PR problem, because any and all sound judicial system must not just deliver justice, it must also be seen as delivering justice. The perceptual component is a necessary but insufficient component of the administration and maintenance of justice. And that is a domain where I think Hong Kong needs to go back on the proactive and the forthright front, and not just demonstrating in responding to critical and cynical remarks and demonstrating that our rule of law remains intact, our judges can indeed rule without interference or arbitrary tempering, right? And on that front, by the way, I strongly recommend to whoever would listen that we cease having these deeply, deeply combative, counterproductive, and also rambunctious criticisms of judges one way or the other, right? Whether it be coming from the so-called, quote-unquote, anti-establishment side, alleging that these judges are bought out, they are the shills, the turncoats, they are plants and instruments of Beijing, or on the other hand, folks in the sort of deeply conservative establishment alleging that, oh, these judges are wearing wigs, oh, these judges are foreign educated, therefore they must be bad judges. That kind of speculation, and by extension, a sort of mindless ostracization and castigation of internationally educated and recognized judges, including those who had served and still serve as non-permanent judges on our CFA, that kind of pressure, that kind of politicization is not helpful. And so what we need on a part of the government is pushing back against politicization from both directions, not just in calling out accounts, right, that try to spin the resignation or the departure of judges as, oh, look at this, this is a sign that we're finished, that rule of law is over, so on and so forth, you know, despite, of course, what certain individual judges might have said, which, again, I would respect, but I would respectfully disagree with as well. On the other hand, also, our government should call out these so-called pro-establishment, so-called pro-Beijing voices that are basically portraying these judges as rebels, okay? We have to deal with the resistance in a judiciary, blah, blah, blah. Such rhetoric, such narratives, they don't just undermine Hong Kong's interests. They also undermine the interests of the entire country, of China as a whole. Because the rule of law of Hong Kong is integral to not just the city's vitality, but also China's ability to deal with the global north and to convince corporations and MNCs that it is serious about committing to the rule of law and transparency in a way that is understood by the developed world as opposed to by other countries as well. That's what I'd say.
So the message there is leave the judge alone.
Please, yes.
Sounds like something out of the Wall album, Leave Us Kids Alone. So, Brian, with all that you've given us, we don't really know who you are when I think about it. Why don't you just give our listeners a little insight into how you have developed and come through the ringer to be a very important voice in the region?
Well, thank you, Jonathan, and you flatter me. I am proud to be a through-and-through Hong Konger. I was born and raised in this very city. And apart from a brief stint in the mainland when I was much younger in Shanghai and Guangzhou, I spent my first 17 years in this planet, in this wondrous city that inculcated in me not just a sense of pride of my identity as a Chinese citizen living in Hong Kong, but also a sense of determination and resolve to keep this sui generis sort of quasi-liminality of Hong Kong alive, that it's uniquely undefinable, that it uniquely resists being pigeonholed. And each and every time folks say the city is done, it's finished, it's dead. Okay, 1980s, post the 1984 Sino-British Declaration, which is, I believe, 6 years after you arrived into the city. Then 1997, the handover, SARS in the early 2000s. Then the great financial turmoil of 08-09. And of course, what I call the decade of discontent. That decade that we just had, you know, in the 2010s, each and every time folks would say, Hong Kong's done, Hong Kong's dead, Hong Kong's finished. But I don't quite believe that. And that is because having spent 8 years at Oxford, and having developed many an opinion that some folks would say are not necessarily conformist with or in concordance with the sort of mainstream views that exist on China, on Hong Kong, on the world, on political and moral philosophy, I've come to the realization that nothing's really set in stone unless one registers and accepts that as a given, okay, in one's mind. And so I've been on this, you might say, naive, but I would say incredibly ardent, a journey of trying to prove to the world that one country, two systems are not just here to stay, but could very well serve as a key part and constituent of China's path forward. The country as a whole, okay, China as a whole, has many, many areas that need redressing, improvement, and also reform. It is a work in progress. China is not very able or capable of communicating emphatically to the world at large. China would benefit from having a more intact and transparent rule of law. China would benefit from governance reforms and also a higher degree of multiculturalism in cities beyond the extraordinary Shanghai and Hong Kong. Hong Kong could serve the role of being a key flag bearer. And I personally believe in reconciling and in also emphatically reinforcing this sort of complementarity between the one country and the two systems. The more distinct the two systems are, despite being integrated, the better the country is off as a whole and overall. And that, to me, is a core part of the reason why, when it comes to helping, you know, Hong Kongers understand China, helping mainland China understand Hong Kong, helping the world understand China, but of course, helping China understand the world as well through more than just binary lenses. I hope I'm playing and able to play a small part, a not particularly significant part, but a part that I'd be proud of having contributed in 70 or 80 years' time when I look back on this very life. I hope it's a life that's well-lived in that sense.
And you can be sure that you're living a good life as you go along. And I was smiling there as you were addressing the topic, because you were actually immediately an advocate for the region, for Hong Kong, for China. And it's obviously deeply ingrained in you. I'm not going to let you off the hook quite that easily, though, because you haven't told us too much about yourself. You've reverted quickly to being an advocate. You're a natural advocate. And I want to just cast your mind back to Oxford Union and when you asked a question of Jordan Peterson. Do you remember?
Yes, I do remember that. Yes, golly.
And that was the first time I was actually aware of you as a debater. So let's just talk about Oxford for a moment. Yeah. How did you get into Oxford?
Well, that wasn't necessarily always preordained. And here I'd like to thank my wonderful head of house, you know, Mrs. Somerville in Island School. Because basically what happened was I got an invitation to interview from Oxford. And I said, you know what, I'm not going to fly to Oxford. I'm going to do a Skype interview. And then when I told her of that, she sort of locked me up in the house office and told me, either you go to Oxford or I'm going to come with you to make you go to Oxford for this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So then I duly went to Oxford and I said, okay, I will take up the Oxford interview and went through the entire process, jumped through the hoops, and I got in. And when I came back, of course, I felt exhilarated. I'd survived that ordeal. 1 month later, I received a letter saying you've been admitted into Oxford. And there I have another gentleman to thank, because obviously going to Oxford was by no means financially easy and straightforward. So I was actually in two minds, and I also got an offer from a very, very, very good university here in Hong Kong with the name of HKU. And I was like, maybe I should do government and laws in lieu of going to Oxford PPE. But then I stumbled across a scholarship application. It was the Kwok Scholarship, and I applied for that. That was set up by the late Dr. Walter Kwok. And in the interview which we had, it was a deeply touching moment for me, because what had originally been sort of scheduled to be a 30-minute interview evolved into a one-hour conversation. And I think at some point in the conversation, Dr. Kwok said to me, if you get the scholarship, will you commit to serving Hong Kong and China? Right? Will you come back as opposed to running off? And I looked him in the eye and said, yes, sir. And I genuinely said it not because I wanted the scholarship, but because I just felt a sense of duty. And so I got the scholarship and was able to head to Oxford for the three transformative years as an undergrad at Pembroke College, which really piqued my interest in rigorous and robust study, in the study of politics and philosophy. I dropped economics and the intersection between them. And it was through those 3 years at Oxford I came to realize the sky is really the limit. We shouldn't be defined by elements and characteristics we can't change. Our ethnicity, where we're born, how we were raised, we can't change that. But what we can change, and I'm not saying I wanted to change it, by the way, to be very clear, But it's just that there was a stereotype and assumption that if you're ethnic Chinese in the UK, you should just focus on getting the grade, stop talking, stop speaking out of your place, this, you're out of your lane, so on and so forth. But I refused to buy into that. I said, you know what, I don't believe in such essentialisms. And I do think I've managed to show that regardless of where you're born and what ethnicity you have, you deserve to have a say and a place at the table. Even if you're from this little city of just 7.5 million that everyone in all had basically written off time and time again, you prove them wrong. You mustn't resort to stereotypes and categorical labels that were slapped onto you before your birth and somehow sustained through your fatalistic submission to them. So I sought to sort of challenge a lot of these conventions, these unspoken norms. I set up the first ever Oxford-based independent publication named the Oxford Political Review, and I'm pleased to announce, having co-founded that publication with a few other like-minded friends over 6.5 years ago, that we're now well into our 15th and 16th editions, and it's still going strong. And that's because through this publication, I wanted to prove a point. You be an Oxford student, undergrad, postgrad, you name it, but you can and should have the confidence and ability to ask questions, to direct questions to some of the quote-unquote biggest minds, biggest names, and the most impressive intellectuals you can think of there. And it is through the OPR that I had the privilege of interviewing folks ranging from Dr. Shashi Tharoor to Noam Chomsky, from Slavoj Žižek to Jeffrey Sachs, from Kevin Rudd to Lenny Robredo and Gina McCarthy, not Raimondo, as well as Kim Campbell, who, for those of you who are Canadian, you'd probably remember her very fondly from those days, subsequent to basically, essentially, as quite a figure in Canadian politics. But long story short, never ever give in to labels, never ever accept these descriptions that are so superficial. They're so condescendingly simplistic. And ultimately, have faith in your ability to rewrite the rules subtly and pragmatically. That, to me, is what Oxford taught. And all that, of course, is not in contradiction with and not in conflict with what I take to be the number one lesson I always teach my students. Be a proper person. Have a sense of conviction. Don't lose sight of your moral compass, even when it's tempting to do so in order to fit in, to blend in. You are more than just the check you earn at end of each month. You're a person, so be one.
Brian, you sit at the table. You've been wonderful. You're a credit to Hong Kong, and thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Thank you.